Just a warm welcome to each one of you, especially those that are joining us perhaps for the very first time. But we gladly welcome you to our 10-part series on worldview thinking. Our hope is that the transcendent and noble ideas about how worldviews are formed, embraced, and subsequently manifested in the behaviors of individuals, families, associations, and nations will help you take a fresh look at your own presuppositions or assumptions, your beliefs and commitments. And our aim here is far more than momentary curiosity. What is worldview all about? I'm curious to know who these various thinkers are that have been promoting this for years and centuries. It is rather to foster an openness for reevaluation and change in the sight of God himself. We pray that this series will serve as a faithful guide for you as you make your journey through this life to the one to come. And so with that, let's look at our objective for today, part three. It's singular in nature to understand how worldviews are formed. There are so many Alps, as you know, and at one time I flew over the German Alps, the Italian Alps, and the Swiss Alps. And from this particular peak, which is almost comparable to Pikes Peak and one of the many 10,000 foot peaks we have here in America, this one is just shy of 10,000. And from the top, you can actually see four countries. This happens to be in Germany right here, but you can also see Austria and Switzerland and Italy from that vantage point. And the reason for using this picture is to remind us that we need to come above our own thinking and to rise up to see things from God's eternal perspective, namely that which he's given to us in his word. In part one of this series, which we began 2 weeks ago, we began building a foundation for worldview analysis by considering 14 distinct but complementary definitions of this idea. The goal of that lecture was to ensure that we would have a general consensus on the meaning of the word worldview, which originally passed from the German language into the English language, and to eliminate as many misunderstandings of the concept as possible. If you'll look at the bottom of this particular slide, you'll see that if you are just coming in today, and we're very glad you are here, you may want to go back and review. You can review the notes, you can listen to the audio, or you can actually watch the webinar for parts one and two. Within last week in part two, we acknowledge first the universal truth that everyone has a worldview. Even if they claim that they don't, that claim itself is a worldview. Number two, we cited 9 reasons why understanding worldviews is so vitally important. 3, we address the widespread and long-standing problem of anti-intellectualism, not only here, but on the continent. And it has spread from Germany over to the UK, to the US, and affected and infected a lot of our universities, our seminaries, our grad schools. And 4, I graphically illustrated worldview differences so that you could see what would happen if you put your worldview next to someone else's, how much in agreement or disagreement would you be? And finally, number 5, we affirmed author Richard Weaver's noteworthy claim that ideas have consequences. And you recall that that's the title of the very famous and widespread published book by that same title. James Sire's definition of worldview is one that I would like to begin with this morning in review. It comes from the sixth edition, and that's important because since he wrote the first edition, thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands of copies of this book has been published and translated into about 20 languages around the world. As you see the subtitle, it's a basic worldview catalog, and I think the title is very apropos, The Universe Next Door. When we are looking through the lens of our own eyes out onto the world, we realize that other people live, so to speak, in another universe. It's very hard to come together, to agree with certain kinds of people. And so we find that conflict arises and sometimes even leads to emotional conflict. But in this sixth edition, which I now have in my possession after reading the third edition many years ago, James Sire says that a worldview is a commitment. This is something he changed from the third, fourth, and fifth editions. It's not just an idea. It's not just the utilization of our minds, but it's a commitment to something that we believe, and out of those beliefs, we behave in the world in which we live. It's a fundamental orientation of the heart, not just the emotions, but recall that we said the heart in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word, means that it's the seat of feeling, but it's also the seat of the intellect and the volition or our wills. So it's a fundamental orientation of the heart, the way we think about things, the way we look at things, the beliefs that we hold. It can be expressed as a story, such as the story of Abraham and how he traveled out of Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the promised land that God had given to him and ultimately the nation of Israel. But it's also, it can be expressed in a set of presuppositions. Those, once again, as I mentioned, are assumptions that we make. Assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false. When we act on an assumption that's false, then we receive the consequences of that, whether it's in the physical realm, the spiritual realm, or even the emotional realm. These assumptions are those which we hold, and we hold them either consciously or unconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality, and that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. Sire having taken that from Paul at Mars Hill. I know that that on first glance for anyone new might be a big portion to bite off. I'm going to read it one more time because it's that important. A worldview is a commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart. It can be expressed as a story or in a set of presuppositions which we hold about the basic constitution of reality, and that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. So today we're going to consider worldview formation and what are the origins of our beliefs. Where did your beliefs come from? And who was shaping you as the potter is shaping this particular pottery? Where did they come from? How did you come to believe in certain truths or in certain things that would lead to the way you live your life, the way you speak? We want to take a good look at that today. Well, from a theistic point of view and a Christian point of view, we began with Genesis 1, where it says that God created man, male and female, in his image. We make that assumption from God's self-revelation in his word. Thinking, therefore, is a God-given capacity and gift. When he made Adam and Eve in the garden, he equipped them not only with a spiritual heart for him to walk with him in the garden, but God gave them the capacity to think. A competing theory, and it's widespread today, is that every person is born without a built-in mental content. And the term they give to that is the Latin phrase tabula rasa. It means, in translation, a blank slate or white paper. And therefore, that all knowledge comes from experience or perception. In other words, when you were born, this particular position states that you had nothing innately given to you as a baby, that it came about from the moment you were born, and then all the data that you took in from your own experience as a baby, then to a child, and in the growth process, or it came from perception. The first proponent of this was Aristotle, and then it moved from there to St. Thomas Aquinas, John Locke, and we also find it in David Hume of Scotland, who was an empiricist. You have to make a choice about which one of those you believe, and that becomes one of the fundamental presuppositions as you build your worldview. If there is no God, then the competing theory of tabula rasa makes sense. If there is a God, and if he has revealed himself to humanity, then you would have to say, there may be another way that I need to think about what it means for me and you to be human. God's law, according to Jeremiah 31:33, is written on every person's heart. God said through Jeremiah that we would no longer have to rely on tablets of stone like the ones that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai in the wilderness. God's eternal and infallible truth is the foundation of all of our thought and morality. So when a person begins to fight against the way he or she has been built, the thinking that comes because God's Spirit has put his word upon our heart, then we find people in turmoil and going against the God of the universe, who knows exactly how he made us and wired us to be his sons and daughters. Another origin is that God has revealed himself to us in four different ways. First, in creation. Romans 1 says also through our conscience, then his infallible word, and then finally, according to the book of Hebrews, through his son, the Lord Jesus Christ, who was the revelation of the invisible God, which he spoke about so often when he referred to God as his Father, Abba, Father. John Locke was the man that I mentioned a moment ago, who believed that we are tabula rasa when we're born. Let's take it directly from him. I read his essay this week. It's called An Essay Concerning Human Understanding. And he says that all ideas come from sensation or reflection. Let us then suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper. Do you remember that translation? Tabula rasa means blank slate or white paper. That's exactly the position that he's taking on the human mind or brain. It's void of all characters when it comes into the world without any ideas. He then asks, how comes it to be furnished? In other words, what comes into the brain to make it work? Whence comes it, or whence does it come? By that vast store. In other words, all the knowledge you have, all the wisdom you have, all the insights, all the experiences, which the busy and boundless fancy of man has pointed on it with an almost endless variety. In other words, the mind is so full. Where did this come from? Whence has it all the materials of reason and knowledge? To this I answer in one word, experience. This is so important in worldview thinking because your starting point will lead you to a particular experience in life and ultimately to consequences before a holy God. Continuing on in the discussion of the origins of our beliefs, we also note that from birth, education is an assumed part of life and is essential to growth and maturity. And we are called to think analogically, that is God's thoughts after him, rather than univocally, which means speaking with our own voice. There may be some who are just now being introduced to those terms, and so I don't want to rush through it. When I say we are called to think analogically, that means we're to think upwards. Ana in the Greek means up, and logic means word, as we find in John 1:1. In the beginning was the logos, the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. So we're logically thinking God's thoughts after him. He initiated everything that is, including the entire material world and the universe. And he also made us in his image, and he made everything that is ex nihilo out of nothing. And so when we think analogically, we're taking God's thoughts as he has given those to us in creation and in special revelation, that is his Bible, the 66 books of the Old and New Testament. We reflect on that, we read it, we meditate on it, we memorize it, we study it until God's thoughts began to supplant thoughts that come about by human reason and therefore may or may not be wrong. We are called to think in that way rather than univocally, and that is listening to our own voice. In other words, we may make an observation, we may make a discovery, and we then may very proudly proclaim, this is what this means, or this is what this is, to refer to Aristotle's law of identity, which means A is A and A is not B. A is what it is, it's a fact. And so if we use our own voice, we have no other voice speaking into us. And so every individual then would go off in his or her own way. Another origin of our beliefs is that we have all been given dominion over the earth. This is called theologically the creation mandate. It's found in Genesis 1:28. And we must be prepared to be a faithful vicegerent to rule over all that God made. And he gave the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and all the animals and all the plants. And he commanded Adam and Eve in the garden to rule over everything, to have dominion over all the earth. And so that becomes a part of our worldview thinking, that we're not just to think as pietists, that is just focusing on the spiritual dimension of life, but actually to consider how tulips are grown, for instance, in the Netherlands, and how salt is mined to this day in Krakow, Poland, or any other physical thing in the universe, including the subjects of astronomy and all forms of science and the social sciences and literature and the like. So we have been given dominion over the earth, and we have been created according to the Psalms, just a little bit lower than the angels, but we have been created with glory and honor. Another origin of our beliefs is that we are all called to seek after and to live in wisdom. This is a very important idea presented not only in Proverbs 1:1-7, but throughout Proverbs, and especially where Jesus is called the wisdom of God, and that we are to seek after wisdom. If anyone lacks wisdom, James says, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and without reproach. That is, he will never slap our hands and say, quit asking me for that. He welcomes it over and over, like the woman who came before the unjust judge and constantly pled her case to him so that he finally gave in, saying, this woman is wearing me out. I will give her what she wants because she is, in fact, coming to me so very often. So we're called to live in wisdom. I always want to emphasize in worldview thinking, therefore, that this is not about the accumulation of massive amounts of knowledge so that a person can answer questions as if they were a participant in Jeopardy, let's say, knowing where all the rivers are geographically and knowing the capitals of all the states in the United States and things like that. This is not ultimately just about knowing, but it's also about doing. Knowing and doing cannot be separated from one another. Beliefs also are instilled, as we all know, by our parents. Proverbs 22:6 says, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. That verse has been translated and interpreted in ways that are really false. This does not mean to train up the child in the way that we think he should go. If you were to study this from the original language or look up a very good commentary on this, you would find that the better way to translate it is train up a child in the way he should go, train up a child according to his way. In other words, anyone listening who has multiple children know that you had to deal with the first child different than the second and the third and ever how many you have had, so that each one of them have nuances. They're all wired differently. They have different personalities. And so this passage is about training the child according to his or her way. And when he is old, he will not depart from that. But our parents have poured so many things into our lives. They have given us knowledge. They have read to us, perhaps. They watch certain movies or television shows with us. They, from experience, perhaps took us camping or took us to the beach for vacation and taught us how to look for shells or how to fish. It's almost endless. If we take the idea that a child stays in the home in America from, let's say, birth until college at 17, 18, then we would say there's 18 years of input developing the belief system of that particular child. Another origin of our beliefs are the things we were taught in school from our teachers, coaches, guest lecturers, our media, and that too is a large, massive body of experience and knowledge. We gain ideas that we absorb from our culture, whether it was in art, music, theater, movies, advertisements, TV, sports, Hollywood, politics, news media, and we could go on. Just living in one's culture absolutely taints or blesses the person who is living in that culture. And that's why thinking is so important, because rather than absorbing everything that comes to us without any critical thinking, enables the culture to shape us more than God's ideas given to us in his word. We also gained ideas from reading. And just several categories would be novels, biographies, nonfiction, journals in our particular field, perhaps of work, theology, philosophy, history, ethics, science, leadership, sermons, great books, which is a special category in academic universities, politics, etc. And that can be a massive amount of ideas that come into us that cause us to look at the world through our lens. And when we're making a decision, we may not even remember that the source was, for instance, East of Eden or Saving Private Ryan, the movie by Spielberg, or any other field of endeavor that we have been involved in. Also, another origin of the things we learn just from life experiences. We know not to put our hand on a hot stove. We know that when we injure ourselves with a laceration, we know what it feels like to get stitches. And we know what it's like to have great joy sitting in the presence of a great orchestra playing Mozart, for instance, or Beethoven, or any of the great composers. So we learn a lot of things in life through experience. And then at times after that experience, we'll say, I would love to do that again. And in other experiences, we would say, I'll never do that again. And it's a warning and it's a correction to a choice that we made using our own developed worldview. And we found that it caused pain or suffering in some way or another. And the last thing is that we learn certain things that we couldn't learn any other way by suffering, loss, and pain. Excuse me. And when the Lord allows these things into our lives, we begin to reflect inwardly and we begin to ask the question, do these things actually shape me into the man that Christ wants me to be? Or do these things cause us to turn away in bitterness and anger? Sometimes our worldview can't be seen. I love this picture that I found where the rail is completely embedded in the tree. James Sire said that our worldview generally lies so deeply embedded in our subconscious that unless we have reflected long and hard, we are unaware of what it is. He believes, and I do as well, along with Oskinis and along with Abraham Kuyper and many others who have studied worldview, that most people walking around today look at the world and they only take it as it comes. Stephen Covey would say, that's not living by design, that's living by default. So since everyone has a worldview, we have to ask, where is it? If a person has never heard of a worldview, they may not even be conscious. As he said here, it's embedded in our subconscious, but we act on it because even if it's unconscious, we believe it to be true when we act on it. And so a person can have a whole worldview that's massive inside of them that they have been reflecting on, thinking on, being trained in, reading about, only to know that when something comes up, they react and they don't know why, because they've never gone back into solitude and silence and reflected on what their worldview really is. So notice that he says that the way to get at that embedded subconscious worldview is through reflection, long and hard. And if we don't do that, we could stay the way we are for the rest of our lives, never being aware of what our worldview really is. Francis Schaeffer said, wherever you look today, the new concept of truth holds the field. Now, what does he mean there? What new concept of truth? Well, before René Descartes in the 17th century, we were in a period called pre-modern. And that's where words meant something. Everyone understood a poem when you cited it or when they read a propositional truth. And then we moved into modernism from Descartes on when he said that famous dictum, I think, therefore I am. And what he did, and this is a bit complex and we don't have time to get into it, but he switched, beginning with the ontological idea of existence or being, and made it instead knowing, I think, therefore I am, rather than I am, and therefore I think. Descartes knew Pascal. He visited Pascal twice in France. They had great conversations. But whereas Pascal embraced Christ, and then, as many of you know, wrote the incredible prose and apologetic for the Christian faith, Ponce, Descartes continued in his unbelief and followed this lie, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. When the modern period came then, rationality and empiricism came in, and everyone was looking for proofs of God's existence. The ontological proof, the cosmological proof, the teleological proof, etc., which we don't need to either go into today. But what is Schaeffer talking about? That's what we're trying to get to. The new concept of truth holds the field. The new truth he's speaking about is postmodernism. And in postmodernism, we find that much of the world gave up on modernism, that is rationality and empiricism, and instead they began to drive their worldview by their emotional reaction to events in life. I just feel this way. And so when we saw the riots this past year, and everyone was breaking in and stealing and burning and pillaging, the one leader, a female, said, we deserve this. So it didn't matter that stealing is wrong under American law, or that it's wrong morally under God's law, and the violation of the Eighth Commandment. All that mattered in that moment is that she felt that way, and all the people ransacking and stealing felt that they deserved this for whatever grievances they held in the past. The consensus about us, Schaeffer continues, is almost monolithic. Whether you review the arts, literature, or just simply read the newspapers and magazines, on every side, you can feel the stranglehold of this new methodology. And by methodology, we mean the way we approach truth and knowing. And I would imagine that all of you know that what's prevalent in our country today is that there is no truth that governs all things. There's no absolute truth. There is no, to use Schaeffer's own term, there's no true truth. All is relative, or the phrase that you'll hear just about more than any other, whether it's on the news or whether it's in print or whether you hear someone say it in your own presence. That is my truth, and that's your truth. You keep your truth, and I'll keep mine. That's what Schaeffer is talking about, the new methodology. It is like suffocating in a particularly bad London fog. And just as fog cannot be kept out by walls or doors, so this consensus comes in all around us till the room we live in is no longer distinct. Words no longer mean anything. Language has been given up. And no one has spoken about this more and in greater length than the theologian, philosopher, Carl F. H. Henry. To the room we live in is no longer distinct, and yet we hardly realize what has happened. And the reason is because our society has been like the frog in the kettle. And gradually, it has been heating up and heating up, and now it has come full circle to what we have today. I would caution everyone here to think in terms that this came about in the last 20 years, or even since John F. Kennedy and his presidency, or even before that. I would like to caution you and remind you to go back and look at history and see that all of this came from René Descartes. We have been living with this gradual transformation of society for over 400 years. The real turning point in America came in 1935, something that we'll delay to another time. But the image there should say something to you and me. The man is walking in a fog. He used to say things that meant something to someone else, and now they look at him and accuse him of being this or that when he's living in the same world of modernism or pre-modernism, but now no one thinks that he has anything to say, even though he's university educated or technically trained, because everybody in the world, for the most part, has embraced a part, if not the whole, of postmodernism. For any of us, James Sire says, to be fully conscious intellectually, we should not only be able to detect the worldviews of others, but be aware of our own. Why it is ours, and why, in the light of so many options, we think it's true. If we have a firm foundation for our worldview thinking, then we'll be able to think analogically again, think God's thoughts after him, and know that we're actually standing on and living in God's truth. But we do need to be aware, and thus, again, this series. You may or may not know the name of John Henry Newman. He was an Anglican priest, born and lived in the UK, and then later in life became a Roman Catholic and became a bishop and a cardinal. And not to mind that at the moment, but he wrote a book that I've read some years ago and reviewed even again this week, called The Idea of the University. And James Sire wrote a whole book about Newman on habits of the mind. And I want to share with you something that I believe will challenge you to expand where you are, no matter where you are, no matter how much education and learning you have, no matter how many experiences, how broadly you've traveled. I think you'll be challenged, as I am, every time I read it. What is the perfection of the intellect? The perfection of the intellect, which is a result of education, and he capitalized that word, that's not a typo, and it's beau, or the word means beautiful, ideal, to be imparted to individuals in their respective measures, is the clear, calm, accurate vision and comprehension of all things, as far as the finite mind can embrace them, each in its place and with its own characteristics upon it. It's almost prophetic from its knowledge of history. It's almost heart-searching from its knowledge of human nature. It has almost supernatural charity from its freedom from littleness and prejudice. It has almost the repose of faith because nothing can startle it. It has almost the beauty and harmony of heavenly contemplation, so intimate is it with the eternal order of things and the music of the spheres. What I'm really seeking to do by bringing John Henry Newman into our discussion this morning is to encourage you, no matter where you are in life, no matter if you're young or middle-aged or you're getting older, or you're perhaps even a few years away from death, it's never too late to look out onto the world with your lens and say, Lord, would you open my eyes to this or to that in all these various fields of inquiry and academics and experience? Would you help me to stop and smell the roses? Would you help me to observe the little baby or the grandchild who's just been born? Would you give me wisdom about how to treat those that have offended me or those that I've offended? But this is exactly what John Henry Newman did. He would not let anything go, and he sought to open up his mind and heart to everything of what he called in the last phrase, the eternal order of things, by which he means those things that God has put into place. The benefits of using our imaginations and engaging in rational thought can be seen in the image of Lucy, one of the four Pinsavi children who go to the professor's home when the bombing occurred in London as Lewis wrote it in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. This is the famous cabinet or wardrobe, if you will, that Lucy entered into, passing all the fur coats that were hanging on both sides. And then as she came to the back of the wardrobe, feeling no back to it, she heard her feet walking on snow and the crunch of snow underneath her feet. She's gone for hours and hours and meets Mr. Tumnus and has experiences, and then comes back, and the other three children think that she's gone mad and accuse her of lying. That no, we just left you in here just a few minutes ago. You have not been gone hours. Of course, Lewis is playing on time and eternity, eternity being one of the features of Narnia. One of the things that happened to Lewis is that he began to read George MacDonald, and in reading Fantasties, a book he found at a train station, it changed his life. And he said that that day his imagination was baptized. Could it be in any way and in different degrees that all of us have stopped thinking? We have stopped wrestling with ideas. Some perhaps have given up and said, I don't want to use my imagination. I just want to do the same things I do. I want to watch this series of TV programs, and I want to be entertained, and I just want to do simple things in my life without really being stretched out into the world. Well, what happens when we do use our imaginations and engage in rational thought? Well, first of all, it promotes personal joy as opposed to succumbing to discouragement or depression, which many people are during this pandemic. It deepens human longing rather than abandoning hope. It gives us desires with a capital D, as C.S. Lewis did when he used the word longing. It strengthens our faith in God when the ground around us seems to be so unstable. We can think about God's sovereignty, his majesty, his power, his protection over us, and his love. And also, the benefits are that it builds a Christian worldview in us by which we may see the world. Hoskins answers the question for us in part by asking, how do we begin? If we're going to build a solid worldview, how do we do it? Hoskins says, in formation, the Christian mind requires persistent obedience to God, not just thinking, but obeying what we know, practicing what we learn from studying scripture and reading Christian books. This is what Guinness calls the responsibility of knowledge. If we think we know, yet do not do, then from a purely biblical sense, we do not really know. Again, being and doing are both necessary for a person to say, I do embrace that biblical truth. So how do we begin? Number one, by lamenting over the deficiencies in our everyday discipleship, that we have been too shallow. Two, by being humble. Developing a Christian worldview begins with an attitude of humility. Lord, would you be my teacher? Would you instruct me? By opening our eyes and being observant and vigilant to everything around us, by being repentant. Hoskins says we have betrayed the great commandment to love God with our minds. We may have loved him with our heart. We may have had some spiritual experiences, but remember that we're to love the Lord our God with all of our hearts, minds, souls, and strength. Five, by offering our minds up to God and asking for wisdom so we may live aright. Six, by seeking God's restoration from the noetic effects of sin, and the nous in Greek is simply the mind, and from the fall of Adam and Eve, our minds also are unable any longer to think the way that we should. That has to be restored as we think God's thoughts after him by his grace. and by recognizing that whatever worldview we adopt will be limited. We never will have a complete Christian worldview, which is why sanctification is a process that takes place from our justification all the way until our death or at glorification. 8, by giving up what seems like our very selves to find our true selves. No longer hold on to the false and the things we have believed for years, perhaps, but rather saying, I'm going down a new path because I want God to build my lens through which I see the world. By actively loving God with our minds. Askinus again, the first great commandment is not optional. To the extent God has given us minds, we must love God with all of our minds and in all of our lives in a way that is shaped decisively by Him. 10, by consciously moving away from the idiot culture. It's also been called the dumbing down of America. 11, by moving away from the shallowest of text, easy read books that present no challenge to thinking. Take the high road and read challenging works to the glory of God. Number 12, by refusing to assume that we can know anything exhaustively, we only know it partially. 13, by moving beyond specialization and reading broadly across many disciplines. Of course, no one is opposed to specialization. Many great things have come to the world through people specializing in their field. But we also need to have people who have specialized who continue to reach out and stretch across many disciplines. 14, by recognizing that television transformed even the life of the mind into entertainment. And finally, by listening to Jesus, where we find in Mark 8, he turned and saw his disciples and he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And so Paul writes to the Colossian church, "Set your mind on the things above, not the things that are on the earth." There are 8 essential worldview questions, and we're going to be wrapping up with only today an introduction. I want you to know that we're coming back to this next week, and we will move into all 8 questions and show you how it fits in with worldview development. These are the questions that everyone in the world, Buddhists, people who follow Confucius, Muslims, Jehovah's Witnesses, it doesn't matter, atheists. What is prime reality, the really real? 2, what is the nature of external reality? That is, what's the nature of the world around us? What is a human being? We delved into that a little bit with John Locke this morning. 4, what happens to a person at death? Is it annihilation? Is it reincarnation? Is it heaven and hell? Just what does happen to a person at death? 5, why is it possible to know anything at all? If you've already studied the field of epistemology, that is, how do you know, or how do you know that you know? This is that question. 6, how do we know what is right and wrong? Where does morality come from? 7, what is the meaning of human history? And we need to know if it's cyclical or whether it's linear, for instance. And finally, 8, what personal life-oriented core commitments are consistent with this worldview? So if a person thinks about his worldview, his beliefs, her thoughts, her presuppositions, then are they consistent in their own life living out those beliefs? So a person can hold to a particular view in their minds and yet live out that particular belief in a different way. So we close today with Hoskinus one last time. What does it mean, he asked, to think Christianly? Thinking Christianly is thinking by Christians about anything and everything in a consistently Christian way, in a manner that is shaped, directed, and restrained by the truth of God's word and God's spirit. I know that there was much, once again, in what we have discussed today. I do want you to know that I'm quite aware that we talked about a theistic worldview today. We will be looking at other assumptions when we follow the 8 questions that James Sire has given to us and evaluate various worldviews in the light of those questions. I'm going to say this as I close, and I learned it first back in the late 70s from Francis Schaeffer right here in Atlanta, Georgia, when I went to a conference and was introduced to him for the very first time and began to understand his own thinking that Christianity provides the only worldview that is livable. It's not perfect because we don't have the answers to all the questions that the world presents to us, but it fits with what we see in reality. What is the really real? We believe that the Christian answer, the biblical answer, is the one that is the true worldview. We're going to explore that, and next week we're going to begin to insert questions at the end, so you may want to think about the questions that you have. Until then, I pray that you, again, will have a great worship experience today, whether you're driving into church or watching online, and pray that this day, this Sabbath that God has given to us, would be blessed in your lives and in your family, and that you would find much rest physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and that God would have you think his thoughts today in a way that's honoring to him. Love you all. God bless you. And Lord willing, we'll see you next week. Thanks.